106.
Just a little loving early in the morning beats a cup of coffee for starting off the day. Just a little loving when the world is yawning makes you wake up feeling good things are coming your way.
Good morning. This is Ridgeway Magazine with me, John Shepherd, and Andy Venton. A very warm welcome. Now, we're going to be very serious today. With the help of Weymouth Business Community, we're going to take a long, hard look at the vexed question of what is best for the peninsula or pavilion site. Is it worth a fortune, or is it almost worthless? Now, there's a question. We tell you about another way to own your own home if you're aged over 50. We investigate shared ownership for the elderly.
No pet patter, our regular feature on animals this week. Instead, we go to Radipole Lake in the heart of Weymouth with some good news for swan lovers who may have read about the dreadful fate of 17 swans and cygnets. Don't believe everything you read in the newspapers.
The biggest question in Weymouth these days is what will be best for the 10-acre harbour-side pavilion or peninsula site. It's got two names, actually. Once a bustling commercial harbour with cross-channel ferries, boat trains that pass through the town on rails that are still there, in later years it became a busy port with a daily fast ferry service to the Channel Islands. Well, the site is now, I suppose you could say, a very large car park with buildings used by small businesses, charities, and there are community workshops. Now, although it's a far cry from its former life, when Channel Island flowers, potatoes, tomatoes and fruit were landed, it does have two of the town's main attractions, the wonderful Sea Life Tower and the now successful Pavilion Theatre. But what next? Now, Ridgeway Magazine has been talking to some of the town's opinion formers, and as you will hear, there are huge misgivings about the latest plans for the area, which everyone agrees constitutes one of the prettiest seaside locations in the whole country. But not only that, Weymouth is the third sunniest spot in Britain. Did you know that? Now, to do the subject justice, we have to go back a few years to discover what has been already planned for the site and how these plans came to nothing. This enables us to set in context the latest hopes or misgivings, depending on which side you are on, in the Great Pavilion debate. But first, a history lesson from Andy.
Well, there have been two pavilions on the site. The first pavilion, an ornate Edwardian affair, was built in 1908 from a winning design submitted in a public competition and opened at Christmas time with a pantomime. The council decided against running it themselves and it was leased eventually. With the advent of talking pictures, the building was adapted to become a cinema in the 1930s. In the war, it was taken over by the military, which wanted to demolish it. It was subsequently damaged in one of the many air raids on the town. At the end of the war, the council took it back and spent several years trying to get compensation for the war damage. It failed. Repairs were carried out and the pavilion became the Ritz Cinema. Refurbishment, which even today destroys famous buildings, did for the old pavilion building when, in 1954, as some residents well remember, it caught fire. The largely wooden building was destroyed in a matter of hours. The cause was the misuse of a blow lamp being used to remove layers of paint from the exterior. The new pavilion rose from the ashes and was opened with a Benny Hill show in 1960. A new element was added to the site, the Ocean Room, or the Ballroom as it was then called, with a sprung maple wood dance floor, which became a very popular feature when dances were held practically every day in the summer season at one time. The new building also doubles as an exhibition centre. The once thriving complex was run in a rather half-hearted way by the council until mounting losses at the beginning of the millennium threatened its closure for being too big, too old at 50, and not well supported. The building was in darkness for a time, but it survived the closure threat and is now run very effectively by the community with volunteer help and professional management.
Now then, the prestigious site's recent predicament started in 2008, 10 years ago, when a company called Howard Holdings won a bid against 8 others to redevelop the site. Now, the company proposed to refurbish the pavilion, build 337 apartments, a 9-storey, 4-star hotel, and a 290-berth marina with a start date of 2011. Now, despite a petition signed by 7,500 local residents saying, among other things, the plan was too grandiose, out of all proportion, and it would mask views of the Nothfort from the Esplanade, the council got carried along with the developer's enthusiasm. But Howard Holdings failed to sign the development contract, having been asked to repeatedly. They ran out of time. The developer, which had overreached itself with a huge development in Ireland and elsewhere, went into administration, leaving the site to its fate. Now, despite spending £4 million on reinforcing the harbour wall to the satisfaction of Condor Ferries, which at that time had bought a larger, more powerful ferry, the company pulled out and a year later moved its Weymouth to Channel Island operations to Poole, leaving the council with a very red face and a bill for £4 million. Now, we'll take a break from the history lesson before bringing you up to date with the latest developments in the Pavey story.
You're listening to Keep 106, the new radio station for Dorchester.
Well, we continue the Weymouth Pavilion site saga by reminding listeners that in past editions of Ridgeway magazine, the Weymouth and Portland council leader, Jeff Cant, has laid out the council's proposals for the 10-acre harbourside site. These proposals were formally adopted last week. We intend to put the other side of the planning story, with views from the business community. Its team leaders are more than a little concerned that they have not been listened to. Last week, the Weymouth and Portland Borough Council met and decided to at last progress their plan for the site. Briefly, the first phase will see the building of a 100-bed hotel, a gastropub with rooms, a small cafe, and the upgrading of services and harbour facilities. The second phase promises to develop leisure units, which were described to Ridgeway magazine at the time as being housed in sheds, the term used to describe cheaply constructed DIY stores. It's difficult to find any support in the town for the proposed plan. We spoke to Weymouth BID, that's the Business Improvement District, the town's Chamber of Commerce, a developer, and in an earlier programme we had the views of the Weymouth Hotels and Guesthouse Association, which said the idea of a hotel on the site was unnecessary as the town is overbedded. Most of the B&B accommodation and smaller hotels are owned by the council, which leases the buildings to the businesses. First up, we sought the views of Weymouth BID and its chief executive officer.
Claudia Moore, tell me, what exactly is Weymouth BID?
Weymouth BID stands for Weymouth Business Improvement District. There's nearly 300 of them across the UK, and our brief is to increase footfall, generate more revenue for the businesses in the area, and to improve trading conditions.
So, you should be jumping up and down with joy when the council say they're going to redevelop the Weymouth Peninsula site. Is that so?
I don't think anyone that I've spoken to in the town is against the site being redeveloped. I think it's just the way in which they're planning to do it is not necessarily what our businesses want.
Well, I mean, are you telling me that you're very hard to please? I mean, what are your objections? Because the councillor told me everything is going to be wonderful.
I think possibly the main issue is the lack of parking. A lot of businesses are very concerned about that, especially Weymouth Pavilion. You know, they're not going to benefit from that. And also all our hotels that are our levy payers as well, when they're struggling to fill rooms, they're not too happy with the idea of having a Premier Inn or a Travel Lodge on the peninsula site.
So what exactly are the, or is the council planning? Because they put in sort of an outline application, it's not set in stone yet. But what exactly do the council see that site having? You've mentioned a hotel.
I think that they're planning to have a pub or a bar as well, and perhaps some indoor activity centres. I think in order to pay for a successful redevelopment, that they would have to include some residential as well. And also, there's a co-working space there now, which is doing really well. It would be great if they could keep something like that. Open spaces for relaxation, sensory areas, green areas, all that kind of thing.
But, I mean, what's wrong with that? I mean, it seems to chime very neatly with ecology and what people want in terms of biodiversity. You haven't really given me a big objection yet.
I think the main objection is that the plans that they've put forward are fairly uninspiring, and it seems to me that not a lot of thought has gone into the planning of it. We put a planning objection forward on behalf of all the levy payers who replied to my request, and I didn't receive any positive feedback on the peninsula plans. I think they just feel that it's going to be taking people away from the town. There's been no thought given to increasing the flow of people between the peninsula and the town, and so far it doesn't seem to be showing any benefit to any of us.
So the idea behind the council's proposition, it's sort of multi-usage. Are you really saying that sort of an operation like that would sort of empty out the town in terms of shopping?
I think having extra hotels, bars or restaurants over on the peninsula would not be benefiting our businesses over here, especially if there was no, as I say, no clear way of flowing from one to the other. I've been working with Way Forward on alternative suggestions for the site. We've been looking at various Scandinavian cities that have peninsulas like ours and what they've done with them. And, you know, plans really can be inspiring, but the ones we have currently are not.
When I was talking to Councillor Jeff Kant, must have been about a year or more ago, when the whole idea was first being mooted, he said that basically what was going to be on the site was going to be leisure operations, sort of rather like DIY sheds, retail sheds. In other words, sort of buildings which were not designed to last for 1,000 years.
I think that's probably quite a short-sighted idea. You know, it'd be great to have something that was a legacy and something that could be a talking point as well. Even if you liked it or disliked it, to be able to come to the peninsula and be astounded by some kind of building, that would be a great thing. You know, like the Sydney Opera House. We've got a great opportunity and hopefully the funding to do something special on the peninsula.
So let's talk about footfall, because you said that one of the objectives of Weymouth PID is to improve footfall. Surely something majestic on the peninsula site would actually increase footfall in the town, wouldn't it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. No, I'm in favour of having something positive on the peninsula site, and you know, none of the businesses that I've spoken to are against developing the peninsula site, but they just don't want it to be in direct competition with the offerings we currently have. We need something special, we need something new. You know, we just need to use our initiative and find something that we don't have.
I mean, what about, I don't know, a swimming pool?
Yeah, a swimming pool or, you know, a trampolining place. Lots of ideas have been put forward. You know, an inside water park, that kind of thing. You know, we do suffer with a lack of wet weather attractions in the town. And it'd be nice if we could provide that sort of offering to our visitors, and something that we don't currently have.
Now, when I was talking to the Weymouth Guesthouse and Leaseholders Association, they told me very clearly that they felt that Weymouth was overbedded.
Yes, I know. Having spoken to a lot of our local hoteliers, they really struggle during the winter months to fill their guest houses and B&Bs. And you know, I've spoken to some owners who are really quite afraid of a Premier Inn coming to the peninsula. It's hard because obviously to get a change of use in our guest houses that are council owned is hard. So they're kind of stuck with it, even if it's not working. And we already have two Premier Inns in Weymouth. And I think to have another one, you know, another chain hotel like that, mid-range hotel, is not doing anyone any favours.
So what's the next step as far as your organisation is concerned?
Well, I've put in an objection on behalf of the levy payers, and I've put in my own personal objection as well. And having looked at the planning application page, there's an awful lot of objections to the site. I think there was perhaps one in favour when I last looked. So I can only hope that everyone will be listened to at the planning meeting.
Well, thank you very much indeed for those views.
Keep 106.
Well, in a nutshell, the views of the Weymouth Business Improvement District on the peninsula can be summed up in one word: uninspiring, coupled with the need for a wet weather attraction on the site. Next, I talked to Craig Oates of the Town's Chamber of Commerce. Now, he echoed much of what the previous speaker had said, not unsurprisingly, given their shared interests. He did make the point that there had been a lack of consultation all around. He did not subscribe to the view held by many that something on the site was necessarily better than nothing. Opinions held a year ago had once now, or have since, hardened, and what is now proposed is simply not good enough. The Chamber does not want to see shops on the site. They might detract from shops in the centre of town, and certainly the idea of one part of the town competing with another part on shopping is definitely not on. But his main point, and that of the Chamber, is that the site demands a focal point, a destination, something in its own right that would draw people to the town. Weymouth has the sands, of course, and the weather, but there's got to be a greater draw to compel people to visit, particularly out of season. An iconic building or a main attraction would do it, and it would be the best use of a very special area. Now, to cover all aspects of the plans for the Pavilion Peninsula, I talked to Mickey Jones of DJ Properties, whose interview had a sting in the tail, so wait for it.
I've spoken to everybody, it seems, in the town, except to a developer. And I'm talking to Mickey Jones of DJ Property, who actually has just bought a site very close to the pavilion. Mickey, what would you do if you had a crystal ball and lots of money? How would you see developing that very valuable 10-acre site?
Well, just before I answer the question, just to point out, I haven't just bought a site close by. I've owned a site nearby and other sites in the town centre for many years. We own the building at 9 Custom House Quay, the former Sharkey's play area, and that was a very big leisure attraction for many years, and that failed for financial reasons. We currently have a planning application submitted to redevelop that site. So I know the area well, and I understand some of the issues and some of the financial concerns. But moving on to the Pavilion Peninsula site, the one thing that's very clear from me is that everybody connected to the town wants some exceptional public space. They want some fantastic spaces where people can walk, they can meet, they can congregate, we can run events, and really enjoy the fantastic views over the beach and around that area of Weymouth. Now, those areas, you know, they produce very little income. So what we have to do is we have to produce something that will generate the value to subsidise those exceptional public spaces. Now, in my opinion, the most value generative use would be residential. So if I was developing that site, I would have a residential-led scheme to generate some tremendous value and use that value really to subsidise some exceptional public space. But in addition to those two uses as well, I fully understand that people want to eat, drink, socialise, and so we do need bars, restaurants, cafes that facilitate that public amenity, that public meeting space to make it exceptional. The other thing I do think that would sit very well would be a hotel, but we have to make sure it's an exceptional hotel. You know, Weymouth has lots of bed spaces, I understand that. So if we're to bring more hotel bed spaces to such a fantastic site, I think what we should do is deliver into the market a standard of bed space that exceeds what we have in the market, or certainly complements it. What I don't think we need to do is just add more mid-market volume into such a fantastic site.
Now, what people have been saying to me, these are the team leaders, they're not residents. Two things, really. One, a hotel isn't needed because Weymouth is overbedded. And the other point is that what is required there is a kind of a destination building or destination facility. In other words, something like, but not necessarily, an art gallery such as you have in St. Ives. I mean, what's your view on that? You've got one destination type building there, which is, of course, the Sea Life Tower. But it rather flies in the front of what you're saying about the necessity of having a residential development there to pay for things.
Dealing with the bed space first, yes, we have plenty of bed space in Weymouth, but it's about delivering something different, something special, something that's going to lift the standards, something that's going to bring a different type of tourism to Weymouth. I really don't think we should provide bed space if it's mid-market and just adds to the other mid-market bed space that we have. Looking at trying to provide the excitement, the wow factor to that site, it's just all about the architecture and how it looks and how it feels. When you go to other European towns and cities with waterfronts, it is the design of their buildings and it's the design of the public spaces that makes them fantastic. You know, the materials that people use, the colours they use, the height. And I would like to see daring, controversial architecture that makes people talk about it. Somebody says, wow, have you seen what they've done in Weymouth? And they really want to come and have a look.
So that actually chimes very well with some of the points that the organisations in the towns have made.
Yes.
Can I just ask you another question? It's a 10-acre site. It's the jewel in the crown.
Yep.
It could very well be transferred to the new unitary authority next year. Mickey, what is that site worth in hard money?
That is the impossible question to answer, because we could all make estimates about its gross development value. So if you took a particular master plan, look at what's going to go there, and then I'm sure we could then go to any suitable surveyor and we could come up with a value as to what it would be worth to let or to sell into the open market. That's not too difficult. However, what we've got to set against that is the very, very substantial costs of developing that site. And the site is very expensive. So, first of all, it's a waterside location, and those are always very expensive to develop. Secondly, we know there are issues with the ground conditions. We know there are issues with the piling, the sheet piling that goes all around Pavilion Peninsula. And we haven't even then got onto the provision of services. Is there enough electricity there? Is there enough water supply? And finally, we have to look at surface water systems. You know, the surface water systems that are in the site at the moment were designed in a different generation. The weather has become far more extreme. And the sort of requirements you have to hit now when you're developing a site, especially with surface water attenuation and the interception and retention of any oils or contamination, the standards are very, very different to what they used to be. So what I'm getting at is, yes, we could estimate what it could be worth one day, but I believe the development costs of that site are very, very sizable because of those special factors. Now, the problem we have in assessing that is we don't have access to that financial information. The information is deemed commercially sensitive by the council, so as such, it's being dealt with by a restricted audience within the council.
Are we saying that that site could be worth a small fortune, or it could, in developers' terms, not be worth very much money at all?
Yeah, it's very, very hard to know. When it is all done, I'm sure it will be very valuable if it's done right, but from getting where we are now to where we want to be could be extraordinarily expensive. This is not an easy site.
Well, I said there was a sting in the tail. The site, far from being worth millions, may have little value to a developer because of the cost of making it ready for construction work. This will involve the demolition of existing buildings and the other costly aspects that Mickey Jones talked about before the first brick is laid. Now, perhaps the council is wise to this and has taken this making ready cost into consideration. But hold hard. We still have the oft-repeated mantra that the council does not listen nor take account of public disquiet. The civic society abhor the idea of reducing car parking spaces, which they say will impact on attendance at the pavilion, and they are not in favour of a hotel on the site. Now, perhaps the issue of a lack of meaningful consultation was best stated by Councillor Christine James, who said in Open Council last week, and I quote, "I don't think the council has listened to the public. I don't think we consulted well. From my point of view, we should go back with a blank canvas. As members, we should have input into the design, and we have had no input." Close quotes. Now, that's a view Ridgeway Magazine has heard many times during the course of putting this report together. And I could say you've heard this from the horse's mouth through Councillor James.
Keep 106.
Now, buying your first home is both stressful and rewarding at the same time, particularly at the time when you first put the key in your front door. A few weeks ago, we introduced the subject of shared ownership as applied to younger buyers hoping to get their feet on the first rung of the housing ladder. Well, now we take a look at shared ownership for older and retired buyers. Over to Gemma Want from Yarlington Homes, who talks to John about shared ownership for older people.
We talked about share ownership a few weeks ago, and that was in the context of younger people and families wanting to own their own homes. Gemma, explain to me exactly how that worked, just to refresh the memories of the other listeners.
Okay, so shared ownership works if there's a couple or young person who has saved up some money, but unfortunately with the house prices at the moment, they aren't able to get a mortgage to cover the full amount of an outright sale property. They have the option to buy a percentage of a property. So they put their deposit down, they get a mortgage to cover the share that they're looking to purchase, normally between 45% and 75% of the outright sale price. And then they pay a rent on the unacquired equity so that they can invest their money into a share of the property without actually having to purchase the whole property.
But they can sort of buy more of it, as it were. But they never own the property, do they? It's on a lease, I believe.
They buy on a leasehold basis. However, if they buy 100% eventually, so they do what we call staircase, so they buy more chunks until they fully own 100% of the property, they will then become the freeholders and there'll be no rent to pay, and they will actually own the property and the land the property sits on. Obviously, in the case of a flat or apartments, they will always remain as a leased property.
Okay, so yes, I've got that in my mind. Now then, you have in fact extended shared ownership to the older generation. And I'm thinking about a development in Panbury at Melrose Court, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes.
So how does that work then if you are older?
So this is a scheme, it's called Shared Ownership for the Elderly. And this particular scheme is for the over 55s. It works similar in the sense that you buy between 45% and 75% of the property value. However, if you purchase at 75%, there is no rent to pay. So it will become, it's almost like you're buying a discounted product because there's no rent to pay. And the idea is this property, it provides extra care for people with a need. So whether it's you need a bit of help with your gardening or your shopping or domestic style issues that you might have at home, you just need someone to come in. That means you've got a need which would make you eligible for this type of property.
Right, so basically you bundle up a lot of services in the rent, is that right?
Well, yes. I mean, like I say, if they buy 75%, there is no rent to pay. There is a monthly service charge, which does cover their apartment. So it's an apartment building, and there's lots of communal facilities. So you've got a dining area, a games area, there's an IT suite, a library. There's a manager that's based on site 24/7. There's always a member of staff on site 24/7. Each apartment is fitted with alarms, so should you have a fall or need assistance, you get a buzzer which you can wear around your neck, and you can press the buzzer, and obviously then you get assistance. And all those things are covered in the service charge to enable people that potentially have an extra need to still live independently in a community facility.
Can you ever own a property in Melrose Court?
No, so 75% is the maximum you can purchase.
I see. Oh, right, I've got it. Now then, okay, let's try and put some figures on it, shall we?
Okay.
Say a property in Melrose Court is on the market for £150,000, and I can put down 75% of that. What's it going to cost me to live there in terms of the service charge for all the facilities that you offer?
Okay, so I can tell you in real-term basis. So a one-bedroom apartment there, they're 200,000. So if you were going to buy a 75% share, that would be 150,000. So you'd pay your 150,000. You bought 75%. There's no rent to pay. So your service charge every month would be £342. And that is the charge which covers all of those extra facilities that we've just spoken about. So obviously the communal facilities, the fact that there's someone on site 24/7, you've got a nighttime concierge staff, you've got safety and security. So there's a video door entry system. So if anyone wants to come and visit you, each apartment is fitted with a video door entry system. So you can actually see that person and then decide if you want to allow them access to the apartment or not. Obviously, the system is fitted with, you know, high-tech fire and smoke detectors, sprinkler systems, communication care lines. So it just covers the whole property, really,
right.
And all your individual needs as well.
Okay, so marketing speak apart from that, and well done, you've told me exactly what you get for your money. Now, this is for older people, Gemma. Mm-hmm. So what happens when that older person dies? Can they leave their property to anybody?
Yeah, so if the person passes away, obviously the property will make up part of their estate, which will normally go, it's normally in a will, but it normally goes to a next of kin or someone that's going to, or an executor of the will, and then it will be down to them to obviously, well, you can put the property on the back on the market.
Oh, you can sell it then, can you?
Yeah, so you'd put it back on the market as a resale property, and then the same would apply. The next person that buys it would have to buy it under the shared ownership extra care scheme, so they'd have to fit the eligibility criteria, but obviously it can be sold on.
Now, if I said to you, how popular is this method of share ownership? I know you're going to say it's absolutely wonderful, but do you have any sort of case histories? I mean, how in essence does it work? Do people welcome it?
Yeah, to be honest, it's quite a new thing for ourselves. So we are finding out, you know, how popular it is. And I think it's something that it's a fantastic scheme, but not many people know about it and are quite wary about it. But we have had a number of shared owners that have already moved in and have expressed how pleased that they made the step and actually took the plunge to do something that they weren't too sure about. We have a lovely lady that's moved in and done a few case studies for us, and she's really benefited from the fact that she can now be independent, so she can go back to her apartment and do whatever she wants to do. She can go out and about in Poundbury, she loves the area, but she can also be a part of a community. So they have activities, they have bingo, they do dancing, there's all sorts of activities, and she can decide if she wants to opt in or opt out. And she said that for her has been brilliant, because she was quite isolated where she was before. She lived on her own in an apartment building which didn't have any community facilities at all, and now she's almost got a new lease of life because she's moved in and she's now got friends around her and people that are there to support her when she needs it, but she can also have her independence.
Right, well, I'm going to say two things, actually, Gemma. One is, if you do go into this, make sure that you have professional advice, solicitor, etc., so that you know exactly what you're getting. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, what's the name of the company and how can they get in touch with you?
Okay, so it's through Yarlington Homes. They can contact us. They can give us a ring. So our number is 01935 404006. Any one of the team can speak to you about that. We also do have an email address if someone wanted to email an inquiry, and that is simply melrosecourt@yhg.co.uk, and all inquiries would be dealt with within 24 hours.
Right. Thank you very much indeed for that.
For the second time in 2 years, the nature reserve at Radipole in Weymouth has been in the news because of the theft of some of their swans. 2 years ago, the report was erroneous, said swan herd Ian Davy at the time. Now, a couple of weeks ago, it was said in the local press that perhaps as many as 17 swans and cygnets had been either stolen or slaughtered for the pot. I visited the reserve and can tell swan lovers the report is wrong. Swans are very territorial, and the truth of the matter is that they may have decamped and crossed the road to another less accessible part of the reserve. But the story did give me the opportunity of visiting and learning that the autumn is the time when you will see more birds than in the summer months. And here I talk to staff member Luke Phillips, who gives me the facts of bird life. I was invited to an open day at the RSPB Centre at Radipole Lake way back in the summer, and I've been told that if you come in the autumn and in the winter, you will see a totally different cast, if I can use that as a word, or a totally different variety of bird life. This is something I did not know, and I didn't realise there were more birds to be seen in autumn than there are in summer. Luke Phillips, explain that to me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, like you say, the sort of cast changes. So, in the summertime, we've got a lot of birds that breed here. So, they travel all the way up from Africa to breed, produce their young. And then, of course, they're going to have to go back. And if you look further north than Radipole, across the whole of the UK, Scandinavia, even places like Iceland, even Greenland, there's birds all over those areas that have to move to Africa. So, Radipole is on the south coast of England, obviously we know that. And that's a prime location for all these birds to be moving through in vast, vast numbers.
So, is this sort of like a stopping off point?
Yeah, think of it as a kind of a motorway sort of service station. So there's literally hundreds of thousands of birds that use Radipole Lake and Lodmore during the autumn. So we're talking August, September, October time.
You're not exaggerating when you say hundreds of thousands, are you?
No, absolutely not. So just looking at one species, which is probably one of our commonest migrants, the little sedge warbler. So these are birds that are actually very hard to see. If you walk around, actually seeing one is quite a challenge. But they live deep in the reed beds. So in August alone, a study that we did back in the mid-90s proved that at the very least we get 10,000 of just the sedge warblers moving through our reed beds in Weymouth. And that's a huge number. And if on a typical autumn day, you know, typical sort of late August day, you're looking out from the window and, you know, the view that we've got currently, I mean, just trying to keep an eye on the sky. You know, we've seen house martins, we've seen swallows, you get sand martins earlier in the year, you get swifts. And if one flies past the window now, probably in a few hours' time, that bird's going to be halfway across the English Channel on its way to France. So every time one of those whizzes past the window, that potentially is a different one. And if you keep counting them all day long, that can tally up into the thousands some days. So when I say hundreds of thousands of birds use Radipole Lake in autumn, that's no exaggeration at all. It's an amazing place.
Now, what about autumn visitors then?
So things that, well, autumn's a fascinating time because all of our population of birds are moving around. And of course, we get some that are sort of rarer than others. So we talked about the really common things like your swallow, which everybody knows are migrants. But there's all sorts of hidden gems that can lurk, you know, in the reed beds. And in the coming weeks as well, we lower the water level at Radipole, and that creates a nice sort of muddy environment for the birds, and that can bring all sorts of waders. And these are birds that have travelled even further than the sedge warblers and the swallows. So these are birds, we've had birds in the past here from North America, you know, Arctic Canada, Greenland, even places like Russia, sort of stopping off little wading birds, different types of ducks. So, you know, just looking at what we can see now. So we've got obviously all the swans, the mallards, the coots and things like that. But coots are a fascinating one. Everybody knows a coot. You know, if you're down by the Gurkha restaurant down there, kids feeding the ducks, the coots are all running around. But in fact, we get coots here that come all the way from places like Poland, Germany, Lithuania, Estonia. They travel vast, vast differences to come here for the winter. And that's basically, if you think of Central Europe or Scandinavia, it gets blinking cold there. And the UK, being an island, stays a little bit warmer than the rest of the continent. And that's why we get this massive influx of birds to the UK. And like I said already, with Radipole Lake being on the south coast, it's kind of on that flyway, it's that motorway sort of service station effect that as they're moving to other places, they're often stopping off here for a bit of a break and a little seaside holiday in Weymouth.
Well, not a bad idea, really. So if we were to go out and walk around, what would we see? I mean, I think you've got to get your eye in before you go bird watching, haven't you? Because you've got very thick reeds here, and I think you've just said, you know, you are lucky to see certain things.
Yeah, definitely. It's worth having your eyes and your ears open, actually. So autumn, a lot of my bird watching when I'm going around, I'm actually listening overhead. And this time of year, there's a really common bird that we get here, which is a bit unusual. It's called a meadow pipit. And that's a bird that actually breeds on upland moorland, heathlands. And, of course, Weymouth hasn't got any upland moorlands or heathlands sort of right next to it as such. So these are birds that are whizzing out overhead. And they make these sort of particularly distinct cheeps and chirps. And if you look up when you hear this, you'll see flocks of things flying overhead. So a lot of migration is kind of active migration. It's all visible migration, we call it, in the sort of bird-watching world. So if you look up and see flocks of birds going over this time of year, it could be all sorts of different things. Even finches, goldfinches, greenfinches, chaffinches, they're all on the move come, you know, next month. October is the best time for those.
Well, I'm sorry to stop Luke Phillips from the RSPB in mid-flight, but we have to close the show. Bless you for listening. From myself, John Shepherd, and Andy Venton, goodbye.